Hello, everyone. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming to you from Washington, we'll have the latest on the tensions in Iraq, seizing war weapons in Cameroon, UN to use unarmed drones in Mali, also ahead World Cup results, and a visit to Sao Paulo's Football Museum. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Sunni militants from the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL, made new gains in their offensives across northern Iraq, prompting Iraq's foreign minister to ask for more support from the United States. But despite the growing desperation of many Iraqis, VOA's Jeff Seldon reports from the Pentagon, U.S. officials have yet to make a move.
Amateur video claiming to show ISIL's assault on Iraq's biggest oil refinery. While in the nearby town, fighters parade through the streets with captured vehicles. In Baghdad Wednesday, Iraq's Shiite Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki lashed out, blaming Sunni Muslim states like Saudi Arabia and Qatar.
What happened is a regional ominous conspiracy that has been planned and financed over meetings.
Yet Iraq says it's also asked for help in the form of U.S. airstrikes, a request confirmed by the top U.S. military official during a hearing in Washington.
We have a request from the Iraqi government for air power.
You do?
We do. And
Think it's in our national security interest to honor that request?
It is in our national security interest to counter ISIL wherever we find them.
The U.S. has been moving military resources to the region, sending the aircraft carrier USS George H.W. Bush to the Persian Gulf and intensifying surveillance flights over Iraq. So far, though, U.S. President Barack Obama has yet to pull the trigger, updating congressional leaders Wednesday at the White House. Still, it's not enough for lawmakers like Republican Senator John McCain.
We predicted that Iraq would fall into chaos if we withdrew all the troops and did not leave a residual force behind.
U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel bristled at any suggestion the administration's to blame for the crisis.
So I think we go back to who is responsible for this. ISIL, they invaded, but also this current government in Iraq has never fulfilled the commitments it made.
Even trying to work with Mr. Maliki's Shiite-led government presents a danger, says former Defense Undersecretary Eric Edelman.
If we try and do this remotely from the air, either with manned or unmanned missions, that we will have to rely on a sectarian government's intelligence to do our targeting. And I don't think that that is going to be a positive thing.
Top U.S. officials, already surprised by the collapse of Iraqi security forces in the country's north, say there are also questions about the forces that, for now, are stiffening in their attempt to hold Baghdad. Jeff Seldon, VOA News, the Pentagon.
And while officials here in Washington met Wednesday about the situation in Iraq, Iraqi government security forces continue to clash with Sunni militants. We get more now from Edward Uranian in the VOA Middle East Bureau.
An official at Iraq's largest oil refinery in the town of Beji, 200 kilometers north of Baghdad, says that Sunni militants have clashed with government security forces and now control three-quarters of the facility. Militants entered the town several days ago, but later withdrew. A Sharqiya TV reported that the militants shelled the Beji refinery, inflicting damage. The TV channel added that foreign workers were evacuated from the complex Tuesday. Iraqi military spokesman Qasem Mohammed Atta insisted that government forces beat back the attack on the Beji refinery, although eyewitnesses dispute his claim. He says that 40 Sunni militants were killed in the clashes and that the Beji facility has been recaptured by the government. He went on to claim that Iraqi government forces have retaken most of the Turkmen town of Tel Afar, 400 kilometers north of Baghdad as well, although fighting continues in scattered pockets. General Atta, who has become the visible face of the Iraqi military, went on to claim that Sunni militants from the Al-Qaeda-linked Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant have taken to wearing women's clothing in Tal Afar in what he calls a sign of their desperation and defeat. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, in his weekly TV address, blasted most of his Sunni rivals and adversaries, both inside and outside the country, blaming them for the current conflict. He says that ISIL militants have joined up with members of former Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein's old boss party to threaten the unity of the country and create sectarian strife. He went on to accuse major Sunni regional powers, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, of abetting the ISIL militants and local Iraqi Sunni politicians of taking part in what he called the outside plot. Mr. Maliki also warned that the sectarian conflict would spread to neighboring Sunni states and tear their countries apart as well. For his part, Saudi Foreign Minister Saad al-Faisal, speaking at an Islamic Unity conference in Jeddah, accused Mr. Maliki of being responsible himself for creating a sectarian conflict and added that Syria's sectarian conflict has made matters even worse. The U.S. has urged Prime Minister Maliki to compromise with his Sunni adversaries and create a new government that is inclusive. Mr. Maliki reportedly won enough seats in Iraq's recent parliamentary election to form a new government. His Sunni opponents, however, accused him of manipulating the electoral results. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
And for more on what's happening in Iraq and the international reaction, check out our website at voanews.com. Still ahead, in Ukraine, the divisions aren't so much about language.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Bomb blast at a site where Nigerian football fans had gathered to watch the World Cup has killed at least 21. Hospital sources said Wednesday that 27 others were injured in the blast, which took place late on Tuesday in the northeastern town of Damaturu. There was no claim of responsibility. Damaturu is capital of Yobe, one of three northeastern states that have been under a state of emergency following a string of deadly attacks linked to Boko Haram. Last week, authorities in the states of Adamawa and Plateau ordered football viewing centers closed because of fear of possible attacks. Boko Haram militants have killed thousands of people during their five-year insurgency, trying to establish an Islamic state in Nigeria's northeast. They've carried out attacks on schools, churches, mosques, bus stations, and other public places. Cameroon's military has arrested an arms dealer and uncovered a huge number of weapons buried in a border village by suspected Boko Haram fighters. The Nigerian militant group has been using northern Cameroon as a base to avoid Nigerian security forces. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon's national radio reports the military found the weapons in the northern village of Blangua following a tip by villagers.
Current defense forces have uncovered and recuperated arms and ammunition which were buried in the bush in the village in Logan and Shari division of the Far North region.
Musa Alamin, who heads the infantry dispatched to Blangua to search the village and recover the arms, told VOA that they may have recovered only a portion of the weapons.
Après une minutieuse recherche, les éléments du 34e bataillon d'infanterie motorisée.
He says after a vigorous search, the soldiers discovered four bags of weapons buried in the village, 35 war weapons, 31 cartridges, and 1,218 bullets. The military recently deployed to Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria to stop the Boko Haram militants group from using the Central African nation as a hideout. Officers suspect the weapons may have been buried by fleeing Boko Haram fighters when Cameroon's military began an offensive against them. Alamin tells VOA that soldiers arrested an arms dealer who supplies Boko Haram with weapons through Chad and Cameroon. He says the dealer's identity was disclosed by arms smugglers after a disagreement over how much they had to pay for his services.
Aji Isiaka, 25 ans de nationalité tchadienne.
He says 25-year-old Aji Isiaka of Chad was arrested at the Waza military control post with more than $15,000 in his possession. The Chadian was transferred to Yaoundé for fear Boko Haram would attack the military post in the north to rescue him. The uncovered weapons, meanwhile, have been transported to Cameroon's far north regional capital of Maroua. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
United Nations peacekeeping chief says he plans to deploy drone aircraft to better help the UN mission in Mali protect civilians. In a briefing on Wednesday before the UN Security Council, Hervé Ladsou said the UN mission in Mali, known as MINUSMA, must be in a position to identify, deter, and mitigate threats.
In this regard, I take this opportunity to signal to the Council our intention to deploy unmanned aerial systems in order to enhance the situational awareness of MINUSMA, as well as its ability to protect civilians and its own personnel.
He did not go into details on the numbers of drones the United Nations would like for the mission or when they could actually be deployed. Mali's government has been battling ethnic Tuareg separatists and Al-Qaeda-linked Islamic extremists since 2012. Also in the news, Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko has proposed instituting a unilateral ceasefire in eastern Ukraine as part of a peace plan. His comments came a day after he discussed a possible ceasefire in a telephone call with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Meantime, Ukrainian Interior Minister Arseniy Avakov said that Wednesday officials believe an explosive device was responsible for a blast at a pipeline carrying Russian gas to the rest of Europe. And this is Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk. He called Wednesday's explosion sabotage, said it was designed to undermine Ukraine's reputation as a reliable partner in transferring energy. The blast, about 200 kilometers east of Kiev, came as Moscow and Kiev face a stalemate over natural gas pricing that led Moscow on Monday to cut supplies to its neighbor. Analysts say an extended cutoff could interfere with gas deliveries across a wide area of Eastern Europe and well beyond. And from the outside, the crisis in Ukraine appears to be drawn along ethnic and linguistic lines between Russian speakers who identify with Russia and Ukrainian speakers who identify with Ukraine. But during a recent visit, VOA's Al Pessin found out it's not so simple.
The complexity of Ukraine's political divide is particularly easy to see here in the southern city of Odessa. In this building at Kulikova Field, dozens of pro-Russian protesters died after a pitched battle with a pro-Western group and an intense fire. But even here, mourners declare their loyalty to Ukraine in Russian.
The people who died here weren't separatists. They were standing for Ukraine, a cohesive Ukraine, but they just wanted federalism.
People in the East are more absolutist and radical. Here, we are more tolerant.
Across town, supporters of Ukraine's pro-European turn finish a rally and pose for a photo.
I've had lots of negotiations with people from Kulikova Field. They are mostly okay, but radicals manipulate them if they don't really know what's going on.
They just historically speaking on the Russian language, but they don't like to be in the Russia. We like our freedom, and doesn't matter which language we speak.
Local journalist Oksana Butuk is not surprised by the lack of hostility among her fellow Odessans.
Language is not a thing that divides in Ukraine. I, for example, grew up in a Ukrainian-speaking family, but I don't feel any aggression or pressure.
And she said that in Russian. To help explain, the regional vice governor, Zoya Kazanji, offers this.
There is a poem in Russian that says you can't understand Russia with your brain. Odessa is not a monolith. There are lots of small Odessas inside Odessa.
She says supporters and opponents of the pro-Western revolution used to get along in Odessa, and she blames provocateurs for stirring up the violence and trying to stoke ethnic tensions that she says never really existed before. The vice governor says her main focus now is on restoring what she calls Odessa's easygoing and multilingual lifestyle. Al Pessin, VOA News, Odessa.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Samantha Power told the U.N. Security Council the apprehension Sunday of Ahmed Abu Qatala near Benghazi, Libya, was justified to prevent more attacks. Abu Qatala is accused of carrying out the deadly 2012 assault on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, which four Americans, including the ambassador, were killed, currently being questioned by the American authorities aboard a ship in the Mediterranean. U.S. Justice Department says he'll be brought to Washington to face three terrorism-related charges, including one that carries the penalty of death. This week marks the 25th anniversary of a landmark U.S. High Court decision on free speech. By a vote of 5-4 back then, the Supreme Court ruled that burning the American flag was a form of political protest and was protected as a free speech under the U.S. Constitution. The decision was controversial at the time and, for some, remains so today. VOA correspondent Jim Malone has more on the impact of the Supreme Court ruling.
The 1989 Supreme Court case on flag burning was set in motion by the actions of Gregory Johnson. He was among a group of demonstrators at the 1984 Republican National Convention in Dallas, Texas, where President Ronald Reagan was nominated for a second term. During a protest denouncing Reagan administration policies, Johnson set fire to an American flag. He was arrested and charged with violating a Texas law on flag desecration. Flag burning was often part of anti-war and anti-government demonstrations during the 1960s and early 1970s. Johnson appealed his conviction, and the case went to the Supreme Court. In 1989, by a vote of 5-4, the High Court ruled that flag burning is legally protected by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which guarantees Americans freedom of speech. Elliot Mintzberg of People for the American Way says the Johnson decision was hailed as a landmark case expanding the rights of free speech.
I do think it does say a lot positive about American ideals to be able to say, as the court did, and as the people have effectively agreed, that you can even take the symbol of our country and burn it and still not be prosecuted for that.
But 25 years later, the flag burning case still evokes strong emotions, especially among military veterans who see the American flag as a vital symbol of democracy. Retired U.S. Army Master Sergeant Louis Chelly is the legislative director for the American Legion, the largest veterans group in the United States.
Well, because the American flag is more than just a piece of cloth. It's representative of the sacrifices of American soldiers. It's representative of the triumphs and also of the struggles of the American people over the course of over 200 years.
Chelly hopes to convince Congress to protect the flag through enactment of an amendment to the U.S. Constitution. That requires the support of two-thirds of the Senate and House of Representatives and three-quarters of the 50 U.S. states.
It's not just the veterans that would be voting on this, it's the American people. And again, overwhelmingly, we find that the American people would support such an amendment.
A 2006 public opinion poll found 56% of those surveyed supported a constitutional amendment to protect the flag, less than the high of 71% in a poll shortly after the Supreme Court ruling in 1989. Free speech advocates like Elliot Mintzberg consider the flag burning case settled law and do not see the kind of political momentum now that would lead to a constitutional amendment.
The American Constitution protects the right of all citizens to disagree, to peacefully protest. Even some of the more important symbols of our republic, and that protection is what provides the freedom that Americans so cherish here and around the world.
But Louis Celli of the American Legion says his group will continue to fight.
To make sure that the people now have the choice to vote on a constitutional change that will protect the symbol of the United States of America.
Celli hopes to convince the next Congress, beginning in 2015, to consider the Flag Amendment. In the years following the Supreme Court ruling, several attempts to pass an amendment protecting the flag from desecration failed. The most recent attempt came in 2006 when the measure was passed by the House but defeated in the Senate by a single vote. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
In the heart of Sao Paulo, Brazil, there is an interactive attraction like no other. It is the city's football museum. World Cup fans, world history, and Brazilian culture. This is one of the country's prime destinations. VOA's Ramon Taylor takes us there.
Over 100 years of football history in one of the most emblematic stadiums in the world. After visiting this museum, you'll understand why Brazilians live and breathe this sport. As you enter the stadium, Brazilian football legend and three-time World Cup champion Pelé welcomes you personally in three languages. In fact, he greets about 1,000 visitors per day on average, 2,000 per day during the World Cup. The sight is a treat for more than just the eyes. You'll hear the sounds of goals and whistles and experience the taste of victory and defeat. Daniela Alfonsi is the museum's content director.
We have 15 rooms in long-term exhibition that works with the emotion, that work with experiences. So in each room, you can feel the voice of the bleachers, of the supporters on the bleachers. You can hear the radio narrations. You can see the football as art, more than as a sport.
Pelé once called football o jogo bonito, or the beautiful game. A nickname that has stuck ever since. In this museum, it is easy to see why. Carlos Acosta is a Colombian who lives in Sao Paulo. He sees Brazilians' passion for football as an inspiration to the world.
It's contagious. The Brazilians breathe football all the time. They eat football. They drink football all day.
There is one room in particular that tugs at every Brazilian's heart. A theater that mourns Brazil's historic 2-1 defeat by Uruguay in the 1950 World Cup final in front of more than 90,000 fans at the Maracanã Stadium in Rio de Janeiro. Luckily, the sadness is short-lived. With a record 5 World Cup titles, Brazilians have a lot to be proud of, as displayed in the interactive Hall of Heroes. And in case that's still not enough to entertain your senses, there are games designed to bring out the competitor in everyone, not to mention an opportunity to become the newest hero of the 2014 World Cup. Reporting from Sao Paulo, Brazil, I'm Ramon Taylor for VOA News.
And this is what happened on Wednesday. Chile eliminating a defending champion, Spain, from the World Cup, beating them 2-0. That was a key Group B match. Earlier in the day, the Netherlands edged Australia 3-2, also in Group B. And in Group A, Croatia beating Cameroon 4-0. You know, you can follow all the action at the World Cup on Twitter. You can find us there at VOA Football and on the Internet at voafootball.com. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today on International Edition here on the Voice of America. Good to have you with us. A reminder, you can always find us on the Internet at voanews.com. And we hope you'll stay tuned for the latest world news. It's coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Thursday.
This is Today in History. On this day in 1623, French philosopher, mathematician, and physicist Blaise Pascal was born. Among his achievements was a theory of projective geometry known as Pascal's theorem. He invented the first mechanical calculator and helped formulate the theory of probability that has influenced the disciplines of economics and social science. On this day in 1862, the U.S. Congress abolished slavery in the U.S. territories. In 1864, during the American Civil War, the Confederate ship Alabama engaged a Union warship, Kearsarge, off the French coast. After a one-hour battle, the Alabama was sunk, putting an end to 2 years of costly attacks on Union shipping. In 1867, Austrian Archduke Ferdinand Maximilian, installed as Emperor of Mexico by French Emperor Napoleon III, was executed on the orders of Mexican President Benito Juarez after French forces withdrew. In 1910, the first Father's Day was observed in Spokane, Washington. Inspired by a church service honoring mothers, a woman whose widowed father had raised her and five siblings convinced church leaders to celebrate fathers. Today, Father's Day is a national day of celebration in the U.S., observed on the third Sunday of June. On this day in 1917, Britain's King George V ordered the British royal family to change its name from the Germanic Saxe-Coburg-Gotha to Windsor. The king made the decision in the midst of World War I when his country was fighting Germany. On June 19, 1953, convicted communist spies Ethel and Julius Rosenberg were executed for passing nuclear secrets to the Soviet Union. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Under pressure from regional bloc neighbors to cease hostilities that have created a humanitarian crisis in East Africa, South Sudan President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar have agreed to negotiate a transitional government of national unity. The United States welcomes the announcement and the hope it offers of ending the suffering of hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese displaced or otherwise affected by the seven-month conflict. Meeting in Addis Ababa, the two rivals said they are committed to finally implementing the peace agreement signed May 9th, but which quickly broke down amid scattered skirmishing. International pressure has been growing on both parties to reach a political settlement and end the fighting. The United States has imposed sanctions on individuals identified as ordering human rights abuses or obstructing the peace process. During the latest meeting on June 10th, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, a regional bloc, threatened to take collective action, including unspecified punitive measures against any party that fails to honor its commitments. The two South Sudanese leaders said they were committed to completing negotiations within 60 days. Keeping to that deadline is critical to restoring peace and stability in the troubled nation. In addition to the atrocities and human rights violations perpetrated against innocent civilians, the fighting has displaced more than 1.3 million people internally and as refugees, and a potential but preventable famine is looming. Fighting must end, and humanitarian groups must be given full and unimpeded access. As the political talks begin, the critical decisions about the way forward should be decided by South Sudanese stakeholders, including civil society and women leaders, in an inclusive dialogue that establishes a genuine transitional government, revises the constitution, holds perpetrators of serious human rights abuses accountable, and sets forth a credible timeline for elections. The United States has long been committed to supporting an end to the crisis, and we will continue intensive diplomatic efforts to press for progress. Counselor for the Department of State Thomas Shannon and Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan Donald Booth attended the IGAD summit in Addis Ababa. They also met with President Kiir and opposition leader Machar to underscore the importance of finding a political solution. Ambassador Booth will remain in the region as needed to support follow-on negotiations. The people of South Sudan have suffered too much for far too long. This agreement offers an opportunity that must not slip as others have. The United States stands with the people of South Sudan and is committed to do everything we can to assist them.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.